for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is up in just a couple of seconds here.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This past Friday, April 22nd, was Earth Day. And in honor of Earth Day, part one of today's program features a conversation with one of the world's most renowned ocean explorers. In part two of today's program, we'll be taking a look at the difficult and complex issue of immigration. Here's part one. This portion of WGTD's Morning Show is devoted to a magnificent book that has been published by National Geographic. It is titled Ocean, A Global Odyssey. It is the handiwork of a host of people from National Geographic, but its primary author is one of the world's most renowned oceanic experts, Sylvia Earle, president and chairman of Mission Blue, a National Geographic explorer at large, former chief scientist of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and named some years ago Hero of the Planet by Time magazine. She has spent decades exploring the world's oceans and writing about both their beauty and their importance to all of us. And this latest effort, this incredible book called Ocean, A Global Odyssey, explores every facet of the ocean and its importance. It's laid out in four sections. First, the living ocean, then life in the ocean, our lives in the ocean, and finally, Atlas of the Ocean. And the book explores the topography of the ocean floor, the nature of the water itself. It explains why oceanic water is salty. It talks about the motion of water, including the tides, and it talks, of course, about the amazing array of life to be found in the oceans. And it also helps explore how the oceans affect every facet of life on this planet and how we as human beings are utterly dependent upon the oceans. Early in the book, she quotes President George W. Bush. The occasion was the setting aside of a large area of ocean waters just off of the Hawaiian Islands. At that dedication ceremony, President Bush said, "Our duty is to use the land and seas wisely, and sometimes not to use them at all." we are just beginning to appreciate what the seas have to offer humanity. And Sylvia Earle herself in this book says at one point, I am a witness, a participant in the greatest era of ocean discovery and ocean decline in the history of mankind. Again, this incredible new book is called Ocean, A Global Odyssey. It comes from National Geographic and its primary author, Sylvia Earle. Sylvia Earle, I am very, very honored to speak with you. In an interview that you did with, I think, Judy Woodruff on PBS, you told a wonderful story about one of your very first encounters with the ocean. It's a lovely story involving you and your mother. And in a sense, it helps us understand why you have loved the ocean and devoted so much of your life and energy to it. Would you mind sharing that story with our listeners?
I think you must be referring to the occasion when I was 3 years old, when I got knocked over by a wave. I was surprised. I turned my back on the ocean. And well, the ocean got my attention for sure. But what has held my attention all these years is the existence of life in the ocean, life that really shapes the nature of our home planet Earth. Earth is, after all, as you can see from the view of astronauts, it's mostly blue. My mother, seeing me get tumbled around in the waves, might have naturally pulled me out and advised me that the ocean was a dangerous place, don't go ever go back again. But when I emerged from being tumbled around, I had a big smile on my face. So she let me jump back in, and I've been basically jumping back in ever since.
One of the real hallmarks of your career is that you began seriously exploring the ocean at a time when it was very uncommon, I mean, all but impossible, for women to do so. That is, women would not be permitted to go on, for instance, deep sea exploration expeditions. Explain how you were able to sort of find your way into this world at a time when it was not typical for women to do so.
Well, I think part of it is a matter of luck, being born at just the right time when the ways and means of exploring the ocean with scuba came into effect, and the attitude of a professor who was open-minded about men and women accessing the sea, and later the head of the program of, it's called the Tech program, of living underwater for days, weeks at a time. When the call went out for applicants to become the counterpart of astronauts, to become aquanauts, to spend time underwater, living in underwater laboratories, was allegedly said, well, half the fish are female, I guess we could put up with some women. It wasn't a thought that women would apply, but some of us did. And, I mean, there's a crusty Navy captain who was skeptical about having women participate for all the reasons that you might think. You know, you're not strong enough, you might not fit in with a male-dominated culture, but in the end, that occasion in 1970 when there were 10 groups of scientists and engineers who took this opportunity to spend 10 days to 2 weeks living underwater, one of the teams was all women. I mean, why not just a mix? I mean, space shuttle includes men and women. But that's now. Back in 1970, the idea of men and women living together underwater was just not acceptable. And so they made a team of just women. I mean, literally, some of the comments were, there could be hanky-panky on the reef. he didn't laugh today, but it was serious at the time, the idea that, that we could not have mixed teams underwater. Mm. But that has changed.
Fortunately.
And having women on research vessels now, not only are women serving as scientists, but leaders, the chief scientists and captains of the ships. Mm. In the 1970s, that was really rare.
Right.
Certainly not in the Navy, let alone in other, even scientific endeavors.
This book from National Geographic, Ocean, A Global Odyssey, is one of the most breathtakingly beautiful books I have ever laid eyes on in my life, and that's about as high a compliment as I can pay. I mean, it is truly extraordinary. One of the things I really appreciate about it is that you take time to focus on and celebrate every facet of the ocean, including its topography. I mean, before we even are talking about the water of the ocean and the life with which the water is teeming, just the topography, the floor of the ocean itself is fascinating. And one of the things you chronicle in one of the early essays in the book is how not that many years ago, we actually knew rather little about the topography of the ocean. Explain how far we have come in terms of being able to map the floor of the ocean, albeit still not completely to this day.
Well, I think that's part of the what this book is all about. It's not only what we know and how we have come to know what we know, but how much more there is to explore and discover. That only, you know, even with a stretch, you could say maybe as much as 20% of the ocean has a fair degree of accuracy, comparable to what we have for, let's say, the moon or Mars or Jupiter or the terrestrial parts of this planet. It means 80% plus really has yet to be mapped with the kind of detail that you expect of our own home planet. We're beginning right now. This decade is an enhanced time of unprecedented exploration. We have new methods of mapping and exploring, of getting people as well as instruments down into the sea to observe and document who lives there, and the equivalent of weather stations that are all over the land that help inform us about the nature of temperature, humidity, and so many other factors that are critical to understanding and predicting, you know, climate, weather, and all the other factors that really shape our lives. But we, until fairly recently, been ignoring the ocean. I mean, there have been buoys on the surface that have transmitted information, but now, both with satellites looking at the surface, but deep within the ocean, instruments that are drifting with the currents, and instruments, in some cases, that actually stay in place and monitor the nature of the physical and chemical characteristics. What's really missing overall is documentation of life in the ocean. Well, on one hand, we've scaled up the extraction of ocean wildlife. We call that fishing to supply what we call seafood or sea products. You know, taking large quantities of squid and krill and small fish to be ground up to serve as a source of the food for cows and chickens and pigs and farmed fish, not just animals that are taken, wild animals taken for human food. And we've been so good at doing this, blindly taking whatever's out there with nets that are indiscriminate. They just take everything in their path, grinding it up. And, you know, if you put that as an equivalent to, say, bulldozing a forest and grinding it all up, you know, we've lost so much, not even knowing the consequences of those actions, except right about now, the loss of 90% of the sharks, 90% of many of the big tunas already gone. We're beginning to understand that this has an impact through the carbon cycle on climate. It's the living ocean that shapes climate and weather. It's not just the physical and nature of distributing temperature around the planet. Mm. And protecting the ocean with large areas where we just leave the fish intact, protect the coral reefs, half of them are already gone, and the kelp forests and seagrass meadows. Imagine if we did not know. The good news is we do know. And around the world, countries are making a commitment to protect at least 30% of the land and 30% of the living ocean in the next, well, by 2030. 30 by 30 is the, mm-hmm. is the goal, which we celebrate in this book, Ocean Odyssey.
You quote early on remarks of President Obama, who dramatically expanded kind of a safe zone that had been established by the George Bush administration. You quote President Obama as saying, "The ocean's health is our health. That is, the health of us collectively as the human race is so dependent on the health of the oceans." In our last minute or so, what would be one or two of your suggestions for the average citizen listening in terms of what ordinary people can do to help safeguard the health of our oceans?
Well, for sure, support those organizations that are out there doing what is possible to do, including supporting the leaders who have the authority to expand protection of the ocean, like national parks on the land that safeguard human health as well as the health of trees and animals and birds and things. The same must be done for the ocean if we are to get from where we are to a better place. John Kerry, who's this nation's international climate leader, he has put it that the climate crisis is an ocean crisis, and solving the climate crisis means we have to solve the ocean crisis. And that means taking the pressure off the ocean wildlife, safeguarding large areas, and becoming knowledgeable. You know, just get up to speed. You look in the mirror and make personal choices that can do what is possible to safeguard the ocean that makes our existence possible.
Well, I can't think of a better way to begin that journey of knowledge about the oceans than to take in hand this spectacularly beautiful and beyond beautiful, important, illuminating book, again titled Ocean, A Global Odyssey from National Geographic, a book of breathtaking, spectacular beauty. And its primary author, Sylvia Earle. Sylvia Earle, thank you so much for your hand in creating this magnificent book, and thank you for all the good work that you have done on behalf of the world's oceans. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you. I hope people will be encouraged to dive in, not just the book, but the ocean itself.
Mm. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. It is hard to think of a more important and vexing issue that is more divisive and difficult to discuss than that of immigration. And that is certainly true here in the United States and in other places around the world as well. The issue of immigration is one that has been at many points in time painfully divisive and difficult. And one of the voices of clarity to which we can listen on this issue is a gentleman by the name of Ali Noorani, who is president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum, which advocates on behalf of immigrants and their dignity. And he has written a previous book called There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. His latest book is titled Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. in which he examines this this complex issue in remarkable detail and with all kinds of compelling insights. I learned a great deal in reading this book and am excited to speak with him about it. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield, again titled Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. And Ali Noorani, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I wonder if we could just take a moment to find out on a more kind of personal level how it is that this issue has become so important to you and what initially drew you to it and compelled you to devote so much of your time and energy and creativity towards it.
Well, I mean, it really begins with my parents. You know, in the early 70s, they immigrated to the United States from Pakistan and really came to the U.S. With one clear goal in mind, and that goal was to make sure that the family they were looking to have would have the opportunities that are available to those who grow up in the United States. And you know, I am forever indebted to the sacrifice they made to lead their families and to, you know, make incredible amount of sacrifices as we were growing up, so that I can live the life that I live. And, you know, my story, it plays out in different ways, in similar ways, every single day across this country. And, you know, there are very few public policy issues that have such a real-time impact on people's lives that, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, it's like every morning I wake up and I just, you know, strongly believe that I am the luckiest person in the world because I just have the best job. And I work with some amazing people. And, you know, this is just such an important issue to so many folks.
One observation you make about the issue of immigration is this. You say immigration can bring out the best in people, unlikely allies, peaceful rallies, courageous immigrants, dedicated lawmakers. I've also seen how the issue can bring out the absolute worst in people, from the local to the national to the international. Why do you think that is? I mean, maybe you think that's true of all kinds of different issues, but I think you're implying there that it is especially true when it comes to the issue of immigration, that it can bring out the best in people and it can bring out the worst. What is it about the issue of immigration that makes that so?
Well, it's interesting because so many Americans, they cherish their family history, their family's immigration history. They'll talk about it, they'll celebrate it, they will pass it on to their children. But they're so skeptical and often just downright fearful of today's immigration experience that kind of dissonance often leads people not just to a place of fear, but a real place of anger. And I think that kind of trajectory to go from fear to anger is to a large part, you know, the result of the weaponization of migration by politicians, whether local, national, or even the international level. That's why I think immigration and the way that we see it, the way that we understand it, the way that we experience immigration can bring out the best in us, but with the wrong factors kind of surrounding us, it can also bring out the worst in some of us as well.
I want to talk for a moment about the circumstances under which you ended up writing this book.
Yeah.
And of course, you did a lot of the writing of Crossing Borders during the fiercest days of the COVID-19 pandemic. And you said that the pandemic froze those of us who were not essential in our tracks. And this book then, Crossing Borders, became less about reporting on the ground and more about learning from afar. Describe in a little more detail what you're talking about. I mean, what your original intentions had been about the book and then what the book had to become instead, thanks to COVID.
Well, in the book, in the first chapter, in fact, I tell the story of Carlos in Honduras, and it was based on a couple of trips that I was able to do to Honduras in 2019. And those trips very much were kind of the beginning, the catalyst for the book idea overall. And in that trip, I really began to understand with much more clarity the complexities of why people choose to immigrate to the U.S. or in essence leave their homes, but also how our systems strip them of their dignity along the way. And the original goal was to kind of do a similar set of reporting in Eastern Europe, trips lined up to Cairo as well as the U.K., just to try to bring a little bit more texture to the stories that I was trying to tell. But fortunately, through the relationship and the work that we do at the National Immigration Forum, I was able to do a lot of that reporting kind of via podcast and kind of conversations. But, it's not quite the same as, being in the room and kind of seeing and feeling the air around you in these different places and really how, people are reacting to the situations that they're in.
Your book does touch on the way this issue has played out in other places. For instance, there's a portion in the book when you talk at some length about the Syrian refugee crisis and how that played out in Europe. How tricky is it when we are talking about, for instance, the crisis at our southern border versus what's going on in Europe? At a glance, they might seem to be very, very similar, and yet the closer we look, of course, there are important differences, although maybe those differences don't matter in light of the sort of the central heart of the story. What kind of care do you think we need to take in terms of talking about immigration on such a vast scale in very different places and maybe where concerns are emerging out of very different circumstances?
Well, when you take a step back and you see that, almost 90 million people now, if you include the 5 million displaced from Ukraine because of the war, 90 million people have been forcibly displaced from their homes, either internally or have left their countries. And that doesn't even begin to get into the number of people who immigrate for work purposes or for family reasons. So we are seeing at this moment in history a massive movement of people. And you really hit the nail on the head, because as I looked at, the situations that migrants are facing in different countries, there are similarities in terms of the ways that, quite frankly, liberal democracies have really tried to kind of externalize their borders, harden their borders, but in doing so, they've played it into the hands of those authoritarians who are looking to undermine democracy by weaponizing migration. But then also the differences in terms, so if those are similarities, the differences also come down to, okay, what is the potential that different countries have to do things differently? And I think that the European Union and the UK, they don't really have a history or culture of immigration. So they are really struggling, both from a social perspective and a policy perspective, in terms of how to manage migration. But they have dire demographic needs for immigrants themselves. The United States, based on our history and our culture, we have a much richer history of immigration. Yet we as a country have really failed to live up to that history, failed to live up to that tradition because of, frankly, by allowing certain politicians to weaponize immigration to the United States for political purposes. So there's differences, there's similarities, but then, there's also a sense of, I found, a real potential for countries and their respective immigration systems just to do a better job of treating people with dignity.
We're speaking with Ali Noorani about his newest book called Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. You have blistering criticism for former President Donald Trump and those who stood with him on the issue of immigration. But one of the things that you are very careful to do is to remind us that kind of anti-immigration rhetoric, nativist, protectionist kind of culture and attitudes were not invented by Donald Trump and his followers, but they have been with us for quite a long time and have actually been a very important ingredient in the fabric of our country. Talk for a moment about that uncomfortable aspect of our own nation's history and what we need to do with that. I mean, Is it something that we accept, or is it, what are we supposed to do with some of these unpleasant realities about our own history?
Well, one of the other catalysts for this book project was a book by Jia Lin Yang, and I think it's published in 2018 or 19, and it's called A Mighty and Irresistible Tide. And what she did in this book is just a remarkable book. It's just one of the best immigration books I've read, is that she looked at the period of time really between 1924 and 1965 and the immigration debate, not from a kind of a big picture academic perspective, but really she got into the political history of the immigration debate, and just tells a riveting story of how after the 1924 Immigration Nationality Act, you saw kind of the eugenics movement take on to get momentum. Really nationalist and kind of fear-mongering members of Congress really tried to kind of close the United States off from immigration. How President Eisenhower had his own kind of dissonance, if you will, in that 1953 decides that realizes that immigration policy is a powerful tool when it comes to diplomatic relations and kind of soft power of the United States, and he welcomes tens of thousands of refugees fleeing communism. At the same time, the very same time, his administration is deporting well over 1 million Mexican immigrants who had come into the United States to shore up our agricultural sector. So you look back over that period of time, that's 60, 70, 80 years, and you realize that, yes, what we are living through right now is not new, and we're always going to go through these kinds of cycles, but to reconcile a nation of immigrants, what we saw in the 1950s and 60s, what we're seeing today, means that we really have to figure out ways where we are creating opportunities for the reconciliation of our communities. Because only then, do you really get a sense of, do political leaders get a sense that weaponizing immigration just doesn't politically pay off.
Hmm. I think it's in chapter 5, titled Fear, where you say, history offers an important example of what is possible. And of course, we look at that history, we look at some of the difficult chapters in our history, but then you look at how we emerged from those difficulties, and that can certainly give us hope for the present. A couple of points of criticism that you raise about President Trump and his immigration policies, probably the most central is just the way he talked about immigrants in a way that stripped them of dignity, in really describing them in a way that in which they weren't even human beings. Explain a couple of the most important tools that Mr. Trump used in the way he would characterize immigrants and shape the narrative about him, about them.
Well, the original subtitle of the book, I think, was going to be, Restoring America's Dignity. Because what I found is that, Trump, through whether it's his rhetoric from day one of his campaign when he alleged that Mexico was sending rapists, to, the constant conflation of immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border with, the fentanyl crisis, and in essence kind of, leading the American public to believe that, they're one and the same, to just the policies that Trump and Stephen Miller and Jeff Sessions put into place. But those policies, that rhetoric, yes, it stripped immigrants of their dignity. But I also believe that it strips the United States and all of us of our dignity. Because what we realize, one of the central kind of definitions, if you will, of dignity is, how you see other people. Do you see them in a dignified way? Do you value who they are? And if you strip people of their dignity, you, in essence, are stripping yourself of value as well. And, that, I think by kind of dehumanizing all of us, including immigrants, I think Trump really kind of stripped us down to our barest kind of elements. And, you know, those bearish elements, those people, those are often driven by fear and anxiety. And he was able to use that to, you know, to further his political ends. So I think that, you know, this is a little bit of a rambling answer, but I really believe that it's not just about stripping immigrants of dignity in terms of what Trump did, but it's really about how he, you know, made us a lesser nation and a lesser people along the way.
I want to ask you about one other interesting turn of phrase, again, regarding former President Trump. You said at one point in the second chapter of your book that Trump planted seeds of doubt that only he was brazen enough to harvest. Can you explain what you're saying there?
Sure. So one of the things that, and this is a tried and true strategy of authoritarians over the course of time, where they will identify something that is mysterious or that, you know, that is hard to understand. And what he will do, you know, and he did this over and over again, and you see other politicians do it, and they'll say, well, we don't know what's happening at the border. We don't know who's coming in the border. You know, we don't know what the government is doing. So by planting those seeds of doubt, and then in the next breath or the next speech or the next day, saying, well, you know, we've got a massive opioid crisis in, you know, rural Pennsylvania, and, you know, I was just on the border yesterday, you know, and I had a bunch of guns and opioid in front of me that were captured by Border Patrol. I don't know. These two things seem connected. So Trump over and over again would very loudly, you know, create these questions in the public's mind and then answer them in the most visceral way possible. And that particular example that I wrote about, I think it was the second or third chapter, is literally he was off the border, you know, the day on Tuesday or Wednesday in a meeting with Customs and Border Protection, you know, claiming that all of these drugs and guns in front of him were captured at the border. Well, yes, they were captured at the border, but they're captured at ports of entry, which is where the majority of drugs, guns, and money were being smuggled. That's a completely different issue than undocumented or unauthorized immigration at the border. And the next day in the cabinet room, or the Roosevelt room, excuse me, in the White House, he's surrounding himself with conservative sheriffs who are all more than happy to kind of distract their residents, their citizens, from an opioid crisis by, you know, claiming, well, it must be immigrants who are bringing in these drugs, which is just the furthest from the truth. Mm.
Your book seeks to help us understand, first of all, certain policies here in the United States that have actually fed the corruption and unrest in other places, in nations like Honduras, which is where your book begins. And your book also helps put a human face on the immigrant, so to speak. I mean, we will meet people who are desperate to come to the United States. We will learn their names, and we will find out what it is, the circumstances of their lives that drives them to wrench themselves and their families from the only home they've ever known in order to seek safety and security here in the United States. And I so appreciate that your book shares that story with us in such compelling fashion.
Thank you. Your
book is also about those places here in the United States where the immigration story has played out in remarkable fashion, albeit not without some turbulence or difficulty, but largely positive success stories, if you will, in terms of immigrants becoming a valued part of their communities. One of the points you end up making is that this often occurs in places that we might think of as very unlikely for immigrants to be welcomed. At least that kind of flies in the face of some of the careless assumptions that we might make. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about here.
Well, I'll give you one example that I wrote about is Storm Lake, Iowa. It's a small town in northwest Iowa that has seen kind of the ups, the downs, the in-betweens of globalization and a fast-changing economy in rural America. And this was probably the most interesting kind of bit of research that I ended up doing, where I ended up kind of in this rabbit hole to learn about Governor Robert Ray, who's a Republican governor of Iowa in the 1970s, who watches some of the amazing reporting that Ed Bradley was doing out of Vietnam around the fall of Saigon, and just says, okay, you know, we as a state of Iowa are going to welcome Vietnamese refugees. And Iowa ends up being a national leader in terms of welcoming Vietnamese refugees, but also pushing, you know, the Carter administration and others to be much more robust in their approach. So Iowa just has this really interesting kind of history that you have to dig a little bit to find. In the 1980s, the farm debt crisis hits, and, you know, people are pushed off of their farms, out of the state, you know, then big agriculture moving in. And all these things are playing out in Storm Lake. They have one of the largest Vietnamese refugee populations. The debt crisis hits, et cetera. So all of this causes an incredible amount of kind of political tension in Storm Lake, because as big ag arrives, you know, they have this massive workforce need, and they start recruiting, by and large, Mexican laborers. And then in the 1990s, who shows up in 1996 but Patrick Buchanan to really weaponize the immigration debate in Storm Lake to try to further his presidential ambitions. Fast forward to the 2000s, and this is still a community that primarily I focused, very conservative, represented by Congressman Steve King. But local civic leadership in Storm Lake, led by in large part by the chief of police and the mayor and others, they decided they are going to make the case locally, regionally, and nationally that Storm Lake is thriving because of immigrants and immigration. And it's just a beautiful set of people. Some they're just really good friends. In fact, I'm going to be out there next week to see them. Where you now have a town that is one of the few towns in rural Iowa that's growing, and that growth is coming because of immigration. But you have Maria Ramos, who, you know, crossed the border illegally in the 1980s with her family. She was a young kid. She's now a U.S. citizen, resident of Storm Lake, and a member of their city council. So Storm Lake is just this microcosm of both the good, the bad, and just the truly inspirational that can happen when it comes to, you know, how communities find reconciliation around immigration. Hmm.
At one point, you write, immigration communities were not just saving Storm Lake from demographic decline, they were sustaining the goodness, the dignity of this small town, offering a template for the nation. I should add parenthetically that I grew up in Iowa and not too far from Storm Lake. So, for instance, I well know the name of Governor Robert Ray, and I already knew something of the story of Storm Lake, but I was excited and grateful to be able to learn still more about it. So what does that template for the nation look like? I mean, what do we do with the story of Storm Lake when it comes to other places? I mean, is that something that can play out in a sense anywhere?
I think it can play out anywhere. In a place like Storm Lake and so many other communities that we work in across the country, it comes down to, you know, the pastor, the police chief, the local CEO, the mayor, the city councilor, all saying, you know what, we've got to band together and help our communities understand the value of immigrants and immigration to them and their families. And it's really important that whether at a local level or the national level, we aren't kind of explaining to people, right? And there's a very kind of thin line between kind of an explanation and a conversation. And what we've found over and over again is that if you're having a conversation with people, addressing their concerns, answering their questions in a very respectful way, over time, the way they're thinking about something as controversial as immigration will change. And then what I've realized is that, you know, we have to welcome that change, and we have to treat that change that people have with grace. because I think so much of our politics these days is wound up in this idea of it's me versus you, and even if you do change your mind, I'm going to hold it against you for what you used to believe. And I think a big problem for us in our politics these days is that we don't allow people to change, and we don't allow people to think of themselves or think of each other differently. And I think that holds us back, not just on immigration, but on so many other issues.
I know that we're just about out of time, but I so appreciate the fact that in, I think, the chapter called From Within, you tell the story of various initiatives and groups like Women of Welcome and More in Common that have found ways for us to start talking about this in ways that are constructive. I mean, at a time when it seems like we struggle so much to have conversations with those who see something differently than we do. Can you just say a quick word about what is so inspiring about these kind of initiatives?
Well, Women of Welcome to me is, I think, it's just one of the most inspirational efforts that I've learned about in, over the years. And this is a group of well over 100,000 conservative and moderate evangelical women across the country who have decided that they want to learn what their faith is truly asking of them in terms of welcoming a stranger. And as a result, they've built these incredible communities across the country, but they've also experienced incredible tension within their own families and their friends networks, so that, you know, when they're going to their mother, their father, their sibling, their church community and saying, you know what, I think we should be welcoming immigrants and refugees to our church, to our community for these reasons. These women are experiencing tremendous pain because, you know, they fear that they may lose their families as a result. And in the face of that pain, they still show so much courage and fortitude in terms of showing compassion to immigrants and refugees. And I just think that, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that we have to understand that fear that people have of, you know, changing their mind means that they could very well lose friends or family relationships that they've had for decades. And that on its own is very, very scary.
Well, it's an amazing story. And for all the difficulties that are associated with the issue of immigration, you seem to remain stalwart in your optimism. I mean, you continue to harbor great hope around this issue for us.
You know, I've been an immigration advocate for a long time. If you're not optimistic, it's hard to get out of bed. But I mean, really, my optimism rests on, you know, the incredible dignity that immigrants and refugees show every single day when they make this decision to leave their homes and to pursue a better life in the United States. And the optimism also rests on the shoulders of, you know, the communities in Storm Lake or the Women of Welcome or otherwise who are saying, you know what, we've got to think about this and do this differently. And I'm going to push myself to get to that place. And, you know, it's hard not to be optimistic after learning about those stories.
The book, again, is Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants, published by Roman and Littlefield and the author Ali Nourani. Ali Nourani, thank you so much for this opportunity for me to speak with you about your very interesting book. Thank you so much and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Tomorrow on the morning show, we look forward to a return visit from Dr. Yuri Maltsev.